The History of Gustavus Adolphus, Duchess Christina, Part 1. It was the beginning of October 1595 when Duke Carl of Sondermanland was setting out from Nykoping, his town of residence, with a cavalry escort of some 500 men. His way lay over rough roads southwards towards the height of Cormadon. The cavalcade had no doubt included a number of women's carriage, for his Duchess Christina accompanied him, and with her went her firstborn, a little fair-haired lad scarcely 10 months old, who was perhaps just taking his first steps at this time. The accounting clerk, who made daily notes of the ducal expenses, refers to him respectfully as, quote, "My gracious lord, Duke Gustavus Adolphus," end of quote. On their way, they stopped at the royal manor of Skennis, on the southern shore of Brocken, and Saturday, October the 4th, they reached their journey's end. This was Sonderkoping, at the date one of the most considerable market towns in the kingdom, and just then presenting a more animated appearance than usual. For it was at Sonderkoping that the Duke and the Rad had appointed the estates of the kingdom to meet to devise remedies for the disturbances which had upset even the tenor of government during the absence of King Sigismund of Poland. It is tempting to see a significant symbolic reason in Gustavus Adolf's presence at Sonderkoping during these autumn weeks when the national regency was once again established and the fundamental conditions laid down for the political struggle with which his life and work were to be concerned. But at that early and peaceful time, he was scarcely likely to have had any inkling of these events which were to be so divisive for himself, or to have retained any memory of his first visits to the little Östergötland town. And we who derive from these old accounts the knowledge that his parents had a new cradle made for the young lord in Sonderkoping are presumably better informed upon that point than he was himself. Among those who may have bent over the simple cradle it cost one doubtier. We think especially of the Chancellor Erik Spar, for at the beginning of the new year he had been honored by an invitation to stand godfather to the boy. At the Sonderkoping Reichstag in 1595, Spar was still one of Karl's adherents, although with inward misgivings. This brilliant noble, the ornament and intellectual leader of the Rod families, did more than anyone on this occasion, Duke Karl himself excepted, to preserve that unity to which the Reichstag resolution bears witness at a moment when internal divisions were threatening. It seems doubtful whether he ever saw his godson again, for the breach was soon complete between the Duke Regent and the increasingly suspicious Rad party. With Erik Spar at their head, the lords refused to defy the veto of their absent king by attending the Reichstag, which, upon his own responsibility, the Duke summoned to Arboga early in 1597, a Reichstag which formed the prelude to a period of revolution in which all regard for the Constitution was simply thrown out. At this Reichstag, as in the preceding one, Karl was accompanied by his wife. It is not recorded whether this time Gustav Adolf was allowed to go with them, but it is certain that the Duke's family viewed only from a distance the events which succeeded it and which led to Sigismund's defeat at Strangbro in 1598 and the great judicial massacre of Linköping in 1600, of which the foremost victim was Barr himself. Contemporaries were generally inclined to fix much of the responsibility for the ruthlessness which characterized Duke Karl's proceedings on his wife, Christina of Holstein. The writers of the defeated party hurled invectives against her with unmeasured bitterness. They were in the habit of likening her to Jezebel, Queen of Ahab, Princess of Sidon, who by false witness compassed the condemnation of Naboth. This odious comparison was itself a hint of their belief in the certainty of imminent misfortune for the whole of Karl's family. According to the word of the prophet Elijah, quote, "Behold, I bring evil upon thee, and will take away thy posterity, and I will cut off all the sons of the house of Ahab," end of quote. Lampoons made free use of the biblical motif in their appeals to the Almighty. May Jezebel never present him with twins, to follow their parents and rival their sins. If the passionate hatred behind such attacks provides some measure by which to estimate their validity, it is on the other hand a well-established fact that Katrina was by many considered to be the help and stay of her husband. The world was prompt enough to expect intercessions and appeals for clemency from a woman in her position. What she did or left undone in this respect, no man now can say. But what we do know of her attitude during these dark years of strife does not give us the impression that she was as heartless or as hostile as the pamphleteers would have us believe. For instance, when the forlorn wife of Gustav Bonner, a member of the Rod, was brought to bed of a son during her husband's last imprisonment, Katrina took her under her care and offered to stand godmother to the child, actions which won the warm commendation of contemporary family chronicler. Though, as a rule, this author writes in a language of burning indignation. It is difficult, then, to avoid the suspicions that those who judged Christina so hardly were not acquainted with her real disposition. But she always was more stable temperamentally than the majority of women and less susceptible to gusts of sentimentality. She demanded submission before she showed herself gracious. Axel Oxenstierna's remark in his memorial oration over her, that she set herself against the proud but spared and protected the humble, gives us an insight into her true character, and her relations with her eldest son were to bear emphatic witness to her unsentimental nature. There was a rumor current that Christina harbored a purely personal grudge against King Sigismund and was anxious to avenge a humiliation he had once subjected her to. The story went that he had courted this princess of Holstein when she was still a mere girl, and had reached the stage of sending her presents in token of his troth, before the affair was finally broken off at his instigation. The tale is substantially true. When Prince Sigismund was chosen King of Poland in 1587, by which time Christina had reached the age of 14, he was still, to all intents and purposes, betrothed to her. The match was viewed with favor by Sigismund's sister, Princess Anna, and by his aunt, Elizabeth of Mecklenburg, and from the Swedish point of view it appeared eminently desirable, since the girl was a good Protestant and was besides cousin to the reigning King of Denmark. But the former of these reasons became dubious validity after Sigismund ascended the throne of Poland. Nevertheless, in spite of his strong Catholic convictions, Sigismund seemed for a time to have felt some hesitation about retracting his promise. No doubt the uncertainty of his position in Poland had its influence upon him. It is thus understandable that the pride and patience of Christina should have been sorely tried. Several years passed. Sigismund, still uncertain of his crown, made advances to the House of Habsburg, with which his relations had hitherto been unfriendly. His marriage to the Archduchess Anna, which was celebrated in the spring of 1592, signified not an inconsiderable success for the policy of the papacy, but Christina was not far behind him in entering the haven of matrimony. In the late summer of the same year, she knelt before the altar with the Duke of Sondermundland, then a widower of 3 years' standing. So we just didn't wait around for somebody else. She had somebody ready to go. And we'll look at some more of her next time. The sources for this are Gustavus Adolphus versus Wallenstein by Pike, Gustav Adolphus, Sweden and the 30 Years' War, 1630-32, by Volk, The Lion of the North by Henty, Gustav Adolphus the Great by Onlund, and Gustav Adolphus and the Rise of Sweden by Roberts, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 1, Infantry by Brzezinski, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 2, Cavalry by Brzezinski. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise. If you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.